Greetings, travellers, and welcome to episode 65 of the Innsmouth Book Club podcast. Today, we are joined by a guest. We're going to be dropping into the Gillman House Hotel to meet with Alexandra Beaumont. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Mendes.
And I'm the other one, Rob Poyton. And you may notice there's some work going on here at the Gillman House. I understand they're doing some renovations, some sort of extension, Tim.
Yeah, they've been installing a pool and things like that. I think they're creating a health spa.
Oh, you know. An Innsmouth health spa. That's interesting. And I did hear a little rumour that it's going to be called the Fat Face Health Spa. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. Indeed so, yeah. I think it was run by somebody called Shay, something like that.
Guaranteed to lose weight and your sanity.
Lose weight and keep it off.
All right, so before we tread the stairs to room 428, I just wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who backed our recent Kickstart. At the time of recording, we've hit over £2,000 and 140 backers.
Absolute madness.
Yeah, it's gone absolutely crazy, this one. That's the new anthology, The Pickman Papers, which is Lovecraftian stories with a Dickensian theme. So that's all going ahead now and hopefully should be out publication by the end of May. So huge thanks to everyone who's backed that.
Absolutely blown away by the response on that. It's I don't know, I can't fathom it, whether it's the subject, you know, the concept of it, but it's really taken off. It's really impressive. So yeah, thanks for that.
Yep, and some great stories in from the usual suspects. I'll be putting a full story list up if I haven't done already. That will be going up very shortly. Okay, let's head upstairs, shall we? And here we are, room 428. Let's have a look and see who's inside. Hey, it's Alex Beaumont. Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
Hi, Rob. Well, thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad. Thanks. Not bad. Is this your first visit to Innsmouth?
Absolutely not. definitely not my first exposure to Innsmouth and deep ones. So I have the very great privilege to be part of a very odd hobby, which is called live action role play. Nice. You can probably actually see some LARP weapons in the background of the of the room, actually.
It's always good to come to Innsmouth armed.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And those are latex fishing spears. So, quite fitting, actually. But no, in my LARP life, I have played many a Cthulhu and Lovecraftian-themed LARP event. So,
amazing.
Excellent, excellent.
Very much not my first trip.
We'll have to chat about that later then, definitely.
Yeah. I'd love to do a Lovecraftian LARPing. I've done pirate LARPing, but I've never done Lovecraftian. But, awesome.
It is good fun. Well, fun in a given definition of going completely crazy.
Yeah. You're in the right place.
We're all mad here, as
they say. Yeah, you do have to be mad to work here. So before we get into all that, perhaps you could tell us something about your background and how you got into weird fiction and how you started writing as well.
Yeah, sure. So I've written for, it's a cliche, but as long as I can remember, really. I mean, it's one of those things that you sort of find a passion for quite early, I think. And so really, although professionally I don't work as a sort of writer originally, like my career wasn't originally as an author, I sort of did a degree in English literature and creative writing sort of when I went to university, and I'd written a lot of sort of different types of fiction just to sort of dabble and see what I liked for many a year before that. Really my passion for sort of gothic and weird fiction sort of came when I was at university, really. I did my dissertation in sort of gothic fiction and how the gothic fiction is translating into some modern fantasy and modern literature and that kind of thing. That's sort of been my passion, really. And then a couple of years ago, well, in lockdown, really, I thought, you know what, there's never going to be a better time to like actually write a book than in lockdown when you can't do anything. I took all of that sort of writing experience, that passion, and sort of used that time to write a book really and just see how it went. And then yeah, it went better than I expected. So
Excellent. Excellent. And that was your first book. Was that The Dissonance of Birdsong? Was that the first one?
so no, my second book is Dissonance of Birdsong. My first book is Testament of the Stars,
Ah, yes.
which is sort of based on Tudor astrology. And basically I had this idea that I thought, what would it be like if there was a religious system based on Tudor astrology? Because it was almost quasi-religious in the Tudor era, in that there was a lot of belief about sort of when you were born under a star, that it meant certain things for your life and that kind of thing. And as we know, stars are quite auspicious in weird fiction, right? And so I kind of, it just got me to thinking, what if there was a world where Christianity wasn't the main sort of Tudor religion and actually it was the stars and the stars were worshipped as gods? And so I created a sort of parallel fantasy world, really, where that was true. And the citizens of Jemind, which is a sort of city based on sort of memory and stars, I sort of based their culture basically on fallen stars that had fallen within the world. And
Right.
there's one fallen star basically within the settlement of Jemind itself, which has had a sort of almost an artificial cave constructed around it. And so the way the astrologers that are the sort of central part of this theocracy that is Jemind work is they will drink the blood of the star and then tap into its memories to really sort of find out truths
Wow.
and sort of use that celestial power to kind of show the way to the people type thing. So that was the kind of idea that sparked it, really.
Excellent.
It's a great idea, and I think people sometimes forget just how sort of influential people like John Dee were at the Elizabethan court.
Oh
Though
yeah,
I guess, yeah, he
absolutely.
also had to be very careful, right? Quite a precarious job.
Oh yeah, you imagine you get something wrong.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, John Dee, as you'll be unsurprised to hear, was a big sort of inspiration point for some of my work on this. And I mean, he's a really interesting historical figure, right? The first 007. I don't know if you know
Yes,
that,
yeah.
but yeah. So, and that was what I wanted to create, really, was that sort of like intrigue and mystery as well that sort of goes with the territory that John Dee would have operated in the Elizabethan era. So,
I mean, there's still some
yeah.
mystery about his life as well, really, or particularly Kelly was a very mysterious character. Not too much seems to be known about him. And the whole thing with the Enochian language as well, which, again, I'm no expert, but from what I read, linguists have said that is an actual language. You know, it's not just a roughly made up thing.
Yeah, I suppose with a lot of languages, you can sort of build them out from sort of root languages and then sort of turn them into something a bit more fantastical, which I guess is what Tolkien did, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and also you've got the direct connection there with John Dee to Mr. Lovecraft, you know, it's Dee is one of the translators of the Necronomicon, you know.
Of
Of course,
course.
how can we forget, you know?
Got to get that intertextuality in there, yep.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, it's that nice thing that Lovecraft did was mixing fictional things in with real things, and you know, until you had people going around libraries searching for the Necronomicon in year one.
Yeah, I think that works quite well as a sort of authorial thing, doesn't it? If you sort of ground some stuff in reality and then add the fantastical on top, that tends to work quite well, which is what I did with my second book that you mentioned before, Dissonance of Birdsong, which is yet to come out as well. But yeah, I always like that kind of layering of something fantastical upon the real. I think, did you watch True Detective? Did that particularly well, I think. I'm sure you must have done, but
Oh yes,
yeah.
the old yellow sign.
Yep,
Yeah.
absolutely.
I thought that I really enjoyed that because it took a lot of people by surprise, but obviously me being a big Chambers fan, I was like on every reference. I was like, oh, that's a oh. So I didn't really spend the first time I watched the series through, I wasn't really paying any attention to what was going on. I was just Easter egg spotting. So they then had to go back and watch it properly. Yeah. But yeah, I thought they did a great job of that.
Absolutely. And I think it is one that is worth watching multiple times because there are sort of layers to it, which is quite impressive, really.
Yes.
A very well-written series.
And is there a new one just coming out with Jodie Foster, I think? I saw something the other day.
Yeah, I believe so. Well, one of the other inspirations for that first True Detective series, apart from Chambers, was actually another one of our favourites, Rob, Thomas Ligotti.
Oh, right. Oh, of course. Yeah.
It was actually a direct influence on the writer. Hmm. So a lot of the language was very Ligotti-esque.
I didn't know that.
That's why it's bleak.
That's where the bleakness came from. If you're ever feeling a bit down or depressed, don't read Thomas Ligotti.
Oh, God. No.
Fair enough. I think it's an interesting one, though, isn't it? Because I think what they've done really well is bring it up to date as well.
Yeah.
Bring that sort of some, because obviously we know that there are some like problems about how Lovecraft's views are now
absolutely
outdated. Yeah. And I think it's important as writers we challenge that and move away from some of that sort of what was there before and what in the era was deemed acceptable but we now know isn't. And so I think it's really important to create weird fiction that is accessible, that is diverse.
Yeah.
And that's something I feel quite passionate about. So I've always sort of been trying to champion diversity in the books that I write, because I remember as a fairly sort of diverse person growing up, I didn't ever feel like I had access to the diversity of fiction that I wanted to see. So I think it's really important that we're now moving into a world where it's possible to write things that are showing that we need to be more equal, championing that and that kind of thing. So for instance, in Testament of the Stars, the two main characters are two women that are sort of in a sort of star-crossed romance with each other. But what I've tried to do with it is not make it feel illegal or anything like that. Like, it's not a gender normative culture. It's sort of all relationships, all belief systems are sort of, apart from the stars, like everything is sort of supposed to be accepted. So there is no like male and female relationships as being normal.
Right,
it's
right.
Female to female or any kind of combination of relationships that you could imagine are normalized in that. And I think it's really important that we sort of move weird fiction into that place where it is championing that diversity as well.
Yeah, no, I think you're right there. And you bring up a very interesting point, because I think something like especially cosmic horror is really, it's fertile ground for that kind of thing. So obviously you've got a real rise in sort of sapphic literature and things like that.
Yep.
And there's not been that many crossovers yet. I mean, Ruth Anna Emrys has done a few bits and pieces with Deep Ones and things like that, and Caitlin Kiernan. But I think it's a real fertile ground for it, because we're all equally insignificant in the face of these tentacular monstrosities from the dawn of time, right? You know? So I think it's, you know, I think in a few years we're going to see a lot more of it. I hope we do.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, I was really keen to be part of that, because what I wanted to do was create sort of these societies where it doesn't matter who you are. It matters. What matters is the story and what people do. And it's people. Yeah. People need to be the heart of it. And there are all sorts of different types of people. And yeah, I think it's just important we start to see that diversity in what traditionally hasn't been a very diverse part of literature, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think literature in general, with perhaps accepting the Gothic genre, representation in literature over the past few hundred years has been fairly lacking.
Yeah,
we get women authors having to say I'm E. Benson rather than or even going under pen names, male pen names, to get published. And I think the Gothic genre is the only one where you have Mary Shelley and various others who could actually publish under their own names. And well, I don't know how strange it was thought at the time or outrageous.
It probably was.
I can imagine it was. Yeah.
It wasn't seen as the norm, was it? I would think. Yeah.
But yeah, it's lovely that we've moved away from that and that there's more of a sort of championing of diversity now in weird fiction. So yeah, as you say, you've listed some names that I think are sort of moving in that space. So yeah, it's great to sort of be part of that, really.
It's really nice. It's nice because I went to a convention recently. I go to quite a lot of these big, the British Fantasy Society conventions and things like that. And for a long time, basically, it was a very sort of, you know, not very diverse. But now you go, you see, it is incredibly diverse, and it's great to see that. And because of this diversity, we're getting some amazing books, amazing literature, because you've got people tapping into what they know and mixing it with other things, and it's just like this whole new canvas has sort of opened up for creativity through it. So, you know, it's great, you know, across the board, really.
Well, even from the perspective of back in its day, I mean, I think Lovecraft's views were extreme even for the time, and the normal views were bad enough, kind of thing. Though he did have his contradictions, of course. He married a Jewish woman, one of his friends was Jewish and gay, and so on and so on. But I think we see a change in that. But even within that, if you think of the stock weird fiction character from that time, was always the guy in tweed, wasn't it? Yeah. So even within that narrow band, it was a very narrow band. They didn't really have working class heroes or anything like
Oh,
that,
no.
or protagonists.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that I sort of looked to do in Testament of the Stars, really, was not have all of, because I think with historical inspired fantasy as well, which I would also describe this as, you often get like the queens and the empresses and things like that. They're the ones, the knights or the like female warriors who have come from like a noble family or whatever. They always seem to be the ones that are like the front and center of the stories and things like that. And while there are some of the characters that do come from that, what I also wanted to do was have a working class protagonist, right? Because like I come from a family where my dad was working class and things like that. And it's about sort of, I think, just feeling seen and feeling represented in like literature, isn't it? Not,
Oh, totally,
it's not
totally.
just heterosexual rich people.
Bloodlines, and we did an episode on Tolkien from an English perspective a
Yes.
little while back, and of course, Tolkien is full of are you the right people? You know, got to have the right people in charge. And we're saying, apart from Sam, who's the biggest cap doffer there is, you know, it's
I'd never really thought about that, I guess. But yeah, they are all, I guess, like the elite of their nations, aren't
Whereas the working class are the orcs, aren't they? You caught me.
they? Yeah. I guess maybe all the hobbits are pretty, well, except Bilbo. And Bilbo and Frodo are obviously like hobbit elite, aren't they? But I suppose the rest of the hobbits a bit.
I see them as country squires, you know.
But I can't remember who said it, but someone made a comment about until the 1930s, 1940s, something like 70 or 80% of the population was illiterate. So you never got those experiences. They were never recorded anywhere. Whereas you can read the diary of an Edwardian country lady and all that kind of stuff, but not her maids, you know.
I mean, this links kind of neatly into one of the things that I sort of talk about in Testament, which sounds like a really awkward segue to try and like self-promote again, which believe me, it wasn't.
Oh, don't worry about it. Rob and I are masters at sneaking our own plugs in there,
Yes,
don't you
we'll
worry.
be coming to that
Indeed, yeah.
Sneaking a little bit of a
You've
self-promote.
got to, you've got to.
absolutely. Who else is gonna?
Exactly.
So, I mean, one of the things that I found quite interesting in sort of the, it wasn't sort of Tudor exactly, but sort of the invention of the first printing presses and that kind of thing, where you were suddenly able to mass produce sort of religious texts and things like that, and sort of move them away from just being sort of these things that only a few people had, and that you did, and that they were sort of not in English and things like that. So the common person who couldn't understand the religious texts, so they had to obviously rely on like priests and things like that to tell them what was allowed and tell them what God was agreeing that they should do with their lives and that kind of thing. And that's very much something I wanted to sort of talk about in Testament of the Stars, because there's these two sort of sides of the nation. Jemind is like the ruling star cult basically, and then Rask, which is like where Tolska, the other protagonist, comes from. And they're attempting to sort of set up a printing press basically to write stuff that is against the stars and things like that. And that's really where like the conflict comes in, really. So sort of thinking back to some of the like Reformation ideas and that kind of thing, that it was so like rife around that time in history and sort of thinking a little bit about like the influence of Martin Luther and on how religious writing changed and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot in there actually now I'm unpacking it.
But that's good. And if you move that to present times, now everyone has access to everything right through the internet.
Yeah.
But we seem to be paying a bit of a price for that at the moment. Perhaps it's a phase we've got to go through, maybe. I don't know.
I think it is. I think it is a phase. Basically, it's all the, like Twitter and everything like that. It seems the way, because I was doing some research a while ago for something I was writing, and I was researching how news was broadcast before newspapers. So you had your ballad singers who would go from village to village and to village and village, and you had these guys with puppet shows who would turn up and reenact murders and things for all the kids outside outside the village pub and things like that every Sunday morning, and so it's basically like a direct link to that, isn't it? Now, when something happens down the road, it's broadcast on the internet,
Yeah.
whereas before, some bloke could go and sing about it down
Yeah.
the local boozer.
And of course, mustn't forget like the importance of plays and that kind of
Indeed,
thing,
yes.
in terms of sort of the retelling of history. So, I mean, Shakespeare's history plays would have been a way that like a lot of people consumed history and sort of formed their views about what happened, which is I guess, like, if we're going to get medieval political on this, then that's why a lot of people think Richard III was as evil as he was, because Shakespeare wrote about it in a propaganda-fueled way in his play and things like that, right? So, yeah.
One of the original fake news, isn't it? But
You had a lot of satire with it as well, didn't you? Sorry, carry on.
Well, and again, probably things that now you wouldn't appreciate, but you can see that in a lot of literature, or some anyway, where you get that someone's having a dig at someone, and we probably don't get the joke now because it's that situation, that person isn't known to us, you know.
Well, I mean, we've picked up on that quite a bit, haven't we, going through Clark Ashton Smith's work?
Yeah.
Because you'll get these very sort of acidic barbs that are obviously aimed at certain editors who will remain nameless. Farnsworth Wright.
Editors and publishers
Yeah,
normally, isn't
yeah,
it?
yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
So how did you get published as well? Do you self-publish, or are you assigned up to a publisher?
Yeah, so I'm linked with a publisher called Bridget Skates Press. It's an American publisher, and so it's a bit of a meandering story. But originally, so there are things called Twitter pitch events. I don't know if you're aware of them, but basically, it's Twitter, and it's a very dense and odd place for many things. But
Yes.
dense in terms of the density of information. There's just so much stuff that seems to happen on Twitter. And one of the things I discovered quite early when I was doing sort of setting up a sort of Twitter page to be sort of my author page and things like that, was I discovered that there was all these authors tweeting like these short tweet length snippets about what their book was about and pitching them to agents and publishers on Twitter. And so I was like, oh, I'll give that a go. I'll see whether this works for me. It probably won't. I was lucky in that I found a different publisher, Gert Dog Press, and they were so they're a sort of publisher of well, were a publisher of diverse fiction and things like that. And so we're trying to sort of again do that thing that we were talking about earlier about create diverse fantasy books and diverse horror books and things like that. So they took on Testament of the Stars. And then, unfortunately, personal circumstances meant that they had to close the publisher about a year after my book was published. But in the meantime, I'd found Bridget Skates Press, and they'd taken on Dissonance of Birdsong, which I can talk a bit more about in a bit. But because they'd taken on one of my books, they happily took on Testament as well. And
That's great.
so Testament is re-releasing with Bridget Skates Press in August this year. And then Dissonance of Birdsong, which was the original contract I signed with them, will be out summer next year. So yeah, it was just really exciting, really. They're a sort of independent press that do fantasy and horror and a number of different things sort of within that broad church. So yeah, and they're a really lovely group of people to work with. So yeah, I'm super lucky.
There seems to be a huge amount of small publishers about at the moment, and a big resurgence in, well, I mean, weird literature in general. I mean, like science fiction, speculative fiction, whatever you want to call it. I mean, because I know Tim, you work with quite a few, didn't you? Now, so.
I do. Yeah, I mean, I publish with. I'm not outside of the random ones that I occasionally have anthologies with, but I have one in Canada, two in the States, one in Sweden, and one in the UK that I work with regularly. It's interesting because it kind of, when I'd first started writing professionally, like what you said earlier, I'd written for years and never did anything with it. There wasn't that many options of trying to get something published. But then about five, six years ago, all these small independent presses sort of mushroomed out of nowhere. And I think it was a direct kickback to the problem that I was having, that it was basically monopolized by these big publishing houses that only published biographies of celebrities who hadn't even reached puberty yet. And do you know what I mean? It was all about like these teeny boy bands and things like that who haven't had a life yet. So why are you writing about their life? And so I was getting incredibly frustrated. So when they all kept all these short, small presses sort of came out of nowhere, it was amazing. It was brilliant. And some of them don't survive, but a lot of them have, which has been absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I think the thing with it as well is when you've got the big publishers and things like that, there's sort of a niche that those publishers are filling, in that you then you see sort of trends and patterns, don't you? Which, like, for a while it was witches, and then it was folklore for a bit and things like that.
Wizard schools,
twinkly vampires.
So they sort of go through trends, don't they? And it's really hard to predict as a sort of starting out author which trend to follow. And I think the beauty of the sort of independent press is you don't need to follow the trends to go through independent presses. It's sort of slightly more diverse, but in a different way, I think, in terms of you see quite different types of story coming out at once from that kind of press. That's always quite positive.
And do you think that's part of a wider thing? Whereas the other night we were watching The Mandalorian, there's like five Star Wars series, there's three Star Trek series, there's a Willow series. It seems to be a huge explosion in that kind of thing for streaming and TV and film as well.
Yeah. I mean, I guess with that, it's sort of a continuation of an established franchise with those rather than sort of creating something new. Yeah. But that said, I loved the latest Mandalorian series, and as a geek, having grown up when geekiness wasn't necessarily like popular, I'm very happy that now we're getting
welcome,
like,
to the club.
Yeah, right. I'm very much happy now to be like living in a world where like you're getting all of this Star Wars content and like a Lord of the Rings series that Amazon put like billions of pounds into and that kind of thing. Yeah. So it's pretty great, right?
Definitely. I remember for so many years you used to say things very quietly under your breath. Yeah, I'm into Doctor Who, whereas now you can go, I'm into Doctor Who and Lord of the Rings, and people are like, "Yay!" It's become acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah. And Dungeons and Dragons, like, I remember that being uncool, but not anymore.
Totally uncool. Yeah.
I remember we used to play on a Sunday afternoon. It was, where are you going on Sunday? Oh, I'm just going around my mates.
Yeah, that's the one. Just going around my mates' house. Yeah.
We're playing football over the park. You want to come? No, I'm going to be a ranger.
That's the one. Yeah. Absolutely.
I've never hidden the geekiness, I don't think. Like, I've always been very open that I'm a LARPer and a D&D-er and things like that. So probably why I was always a massive geek at school.
Yeah. Well, I was doubly outcast because I was a geek and a goth. So, so I was the weird kid at the back of the class. That was me.
Yeah, me too. I was a geek and a goth as well. Like, my teen years listening to Nightwish and Evanescence definitely where it was at.
So let's talk about the gaming and the LARPing in particular. So how did you get into that? Well, you've been playing Dungeons and Dragons before, kind of thing, or RPGs in general, and
I LARPed before I did D&D, weirdly.
all right.
How I got into LARPing was I knew some people through, I don't know, friendship groups and whatever that were doing it, and I was already massively into like Lord of the Rings by that point and things like that. So I just went along with some people that were going just to see what it was like. I mean, this was like over 20 years ago now, and I just kept doing it since. And I think my LARP style has changed quite a lot over the years, which is interesting. There's a great meme which is kind of like about the change of style of people's kit as they like costumes that they wear as they sort of generate through LARP. And that's very relatable. Like there's sort of shiny armor that you first have when you first do LARP, and then it becomes more and more about like how many good hats you have and things like that. But for me, like I very much remember like having wanted to play, and I think as everyone who LARPs, I think, goes through a little bit of like this transition where they want to play like a certain type of character that appeals to them when they're a teenager, and then later on they sort of change quite a bit and their character style and choice changes with them. So for me, very much like when I was a teenager, I wanted to be like the kind of, I don't know, shiny hero of the story and things like that, who was very like obviously like good and driven in a certain angle and things like that. And yeah. And so my kit was very like neat, and I wanted it to look like I was very sort of tidy and pristine and things like that. Now, like the more leaves and mud and like detritus that's on my kit is like the better. So I play a very ragtag ranger at the moment, and like yeah, if I can get covered in mud and put like makeup on my face to look like a rough and ready ranger, like we're happy. Yeah, for sure.
So much the better.
Nice. I had the thing years ago because I was in a pirate band. We did all dirty sea shanties, and we used to play like the reenactment festivals
Oh, cool.
and things like that. But our mandolin player, he was always washing his shirt, so he was always like bright and shiny white. And it's like, dude, we're pirates. It's just like, go get some mud on you. Go on. But do you at LARPing? Because I've taken part in a few LARPing things, but not really to any great degree. Do you get the kit police like you get at reenactments? The guys who go around going, those buttons are anachronistic.
Not as much, no. So I've done reenactment as well, which yeah, definitely there's a bit of that, but
Oh, the kit police, they make me laugh.
yeah, I mean, you can kind of see why at reenactment, I guess,
Oh,
because you're sort of trying to specifically recreate a period of history. A LARP, not so much. Like it's a pretty sort of broad church in terms of like accepting what people want to do and that kind of thing, which is lovely. I think in some systems, it depends on the system you play. Like there are fest systems which are quite big, and sort of there's a you'll get like about 1,000 people at those type thing, and the costumes are a bit more sort of like whatever you want to wear at those and things like that. At sort of slightly smaller systems, some of them do curate like the style of kit a little bit more, and things like that, to kind of say like this is the style of kit that we want people to wear to represent sort of the world we're trying to build type thing. A good example of that, I guess, is like there's a Witcher LARP, and the Witcher LARP, they sort of have some examples, or they have a sort of obviously like quite a clear style of similar stuff to what people wear in The Witcher and things like that, which yeah, that makes sense. And I guess also with the Cthulhu LARP I mentioned earlier, that's another one I've been to where there's like they're not over strict with it, but there's kind of like a please dress as if you were in the era in which you're playing and that kind of thing, which makes sense.
Sort of 1930s dress.
Yeah, I mean, they do have sort of range. They do sort of 2030s games, but I've also been to a 1940s game, a 1960s game. So there's a bit of a
Oh, that's cool.
variation there as well.
Awesome.
So, with the Cthulhu LARPing in particular, how do they handle the inevitable sanity loss that comes from doing anything in a Call of Cthulhu scenario.
Yeah, so there's a sort of rule system that basically you run with, so you'll have a sort of set sanity number, and then there'll be sort of like a number called out, and they'll sort of say like they'll the game organizers will yell like san loss type thing, and then yell a number, and then you know sort of roughly how to detract, how much to detract based on that. I've simplified that for the purposes of explaining, not explaining like a really detailed rule set on a podcast, which is probably quite boring. But yeah, I'd recommend checking out like the systems called Disturbing Events, which I have a feeling you might know some people from it. But yeah.
Very probably, yeah.
Well, and because I guess something like that, you can't probably run it that often because the setting is going to be, well, I guess even for general LARP, I mean, 1,000 people taking part in something that needs a fair amount of organization and space.
Yeah, and I mean the Disturbing Events games tend to be quite a lot smaller. They sort of tend to have a game like the largest game I think I've been in was probably around 30 people or something. So those are a lot smaller, kind of by dint of the fact that you're using like manor houses and like indoor venues and things like that. So whereas a lot of festival LARP events are like big fields. So
The ones I went to were at Lulworth Cove, so a beach. So,
oh, cool.
you're guaranteed you're going to end up in the sea at some point. So, for part of the fun, right?
Perfect. Yeah, absolutely.
And in terms of the mechanics, I mean, everyone now is used to people sitting around a table rolling dice and all that kind of thing. But is it mostly down to like the sort of I don't know, is the referee the term? Is it the referee and the players working together to determine an outcome? How does that work?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, again, it depends on the event and the system in terms of how they run it. The bigger events have a fairly sort of structured rule system because you kind of have to. So just to sort of basically explain it, tends to be you'll have like a certain amount of hit points per location, like body location, which is probably like head, arms, chest, legs, and then you'll go into a fight and people will hit you with their weapons and things like that, and you'll know like if it's just a normal blow, that's like taking one hit off of your armor or you or something like that. But then they might do sort of bigger damage calls and things like that, which takes more off. And it's just kind of a rule system to make it simple and fairly transparent about like when you're supposed to go down and that kind of thing. And yeah, they always say if you're uncertain, just like fall over and then ask a healer. I've just been hit with this. What does it mean? Type thing. But yeah.
That's pretty general good advice for life. If you're uncertain, just fall over and lay still. People
Yeah.
know,
Become a hedgehog. That's always been my advice. Just go down and be a hedgehog.
And I spent a little bit of time in sort of paintball and the airsoft sort of arena, and there you do occasionally get issues with, people wiping the paint off and all that sort of stuff.
There's always one in there. There's always one.
I've seen some arguments. Do you get that same thing, or is everyone of the same mindset? Everyone's there to enjoy it and.
Yeah, pretty much everyone's there to enjoy it. I mean, with all of these things, like if you're in a big battle, it's sometimes easy to like miscount how many times you've been hit or things like that. So, but generally, people are pretty good with like the spirit of the rules and trying not to like cheat, essentially. But I guess that's why the refs are there, really, is to like have a lookout for if there are people that are obviously like taking too many hits or not responding to the damage calls that they've had hit been hit with, that kind of thing.
A mate of mine does a lot of paintballing, Rob, and what he told me is chamois leather and a hip flask of white spirit.
That's our professional cheating kit.
That's professional cheating
Wow.
right there.
It kind of why are you doing to me it's well anyway that's you'll always get one
I
off.
should probably say it's not him that
All
does that.
right,
He
right.
knows
Oh,
people
that's
who
yeah.
do
I
it.
was gonna say he'll probably tell you off for giving away his secret.
No, he was moaning about it down the
Oh,
pub. That's how I know it. It was like this guy, blah blah blah.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you was with the weapons, the spears and everything. Are you training those? Because I've been practicing in martial arts for quite a while, which includes sword work and everything. So do you train with those, and do you draw on historical sources, and how do you adapt that for, well, I mean, a lot of them are historical weapons, but there must be non-historical weapons as well, perhaps.
Yeah, there definitely are. I mean, I think people, again, with like some systems, it's quite flexible about the type of weapon you can use, as long as it's like safe and passes like the safety checks and things like that of the game. Yeah, I mean, for me, well, because I did medieval reenactment, I a lot of my and I did reenactment sort of around about the same time where I was starting to LARP. So I was learning to fight sort of with metal swords then and things like that. So obviously there's quite a different fighting style to learning with metal, as I'm sure you know, because you've got to do bigger swings, you've got to make sure you're doing it in a certain way and that kind of thing. And so yeah, I learned with that sort of structure really. So my fighting style is what at LARP you would call heroic, because you're doing like full swings of the blades and things like that. Whereas some people have slightly lighter weapons and they can like flick them into like a bit more like fencing, they can flick them into a situation.
Exactly, the tappy tap sort of, kind of
Yeah, a
sort of.
little bit it can be tappy tap, but I mean a lot of it is like some people with sort of lighter weapons are able to do quite a fencing style of like hit and withdraw and duel in that fashion. It's different styles of fighting, they're all legitimate. Yeah, but for me, I was always found that learning with metal meant that I had to do things in a slightly different way, because I was quite fast swinging the weapon around. Like it's like heroic swings instead of the tappy taps. And yeah, I think the main thing for me was because when you learn in reenactment, you have to learn in a very different way. And you have a metal buckler, which you're allowed to punch people in the head with, because everyone's wearing like 14 gauge steel helmets. And so that's a safe thing to do in that environment. But then when you come back LARPing and you have a sword and shield, definitely like
No punching.
reminding yourself, don't shield punch someone is quite
Yeah,
a thing.
I got told off when I did my first LARP event because I was going for it in the same way I'd done at
Yeah, I
reenactment.
was lucky that I was doing LARP and reenactment at the same time, so I learned the two different fighting styles like in tandem. But yeah, it's very easy.
Yeah, no, I went for it. I was like, I have some of
It's very, very different styles of
that.
fighting, isn't it?
So let's talk about conventions. Because I believe there might be one coming up.
Is there? Oh.
Yes, Alex has kindly agreed to come along and be a guest at the Innsmouth Literary Festival, which, as I'm sure listeners will know by now, is being held on the 30th of September in Bedford. And we've got a great panel of guests, and we've got Ramsay Campbell appearing over Zoom, traders, gaming, all sorts of stuff. So, have you done any conventions before? I've never done any, and Tim, you've done a few now. What have your experiences been at those? How have you found them?
This is my first convention, so.
All right, okay. Ignore all those questions there.
But no, I'm looking forward to it. It should be good fun. Yeah, I thought it was a sort of good opportunity to come and try one out, really. So yeah, we'll see how it goes. I'm still trying to work out sort of what kind of merch I can get to put on my stall, because I clearly need something.
Oh yeah. Merch is always good. That's my advice. Do you know what my best selling thing out of everything that I have is? My ridiculous pin badges with parental advisory tentacles on them. Seriously,
Very
that's my
good.
best seller.
Very good. I like it. Yeah, I'm obviously going to have some books that will, because I hopefully Testament will have just re-released by then with its new cover, so I should have some signed copies of my book with me. But yeah, I also want some cool stuff with stars on or something like that.
T-shirts always
Be
go
quite
down
good.
well, posters, that kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah.
Although, having said that, I just did a Bedford Comic Convention last week and sold four items in the whole day. It was totally the wrong
That's a totally
audience.
different beast, though. It's a totally different. Comic cons are totally different to the sort of more literary events. Whereas, like the ones that I've done, because I've never done a Comic Con like you have. I've always done the literary ones. Whereas all the merch, all the traders there, it's all either books or book related things or sort of, you know, crafty, more crafty things. Whereas Comic Cons, it's all Funko Pops, isn't it, and action figures. And
well, that's what surprised me, because for a Comic Con, there was one comic guy there who I'd sold a lot of my collection to a while back and was looking at my own comics and thinking, oh, I wish I'd have kept that. And that was it. Like you say, everything else was Funko Pops, yeah. and pretty much it, and cosplay. There was a lot of cosplay going on.
Yeah, whereas you don't tend to get much cosplay at all at the sort of ones I do. They tend to have, like, on usually the Saturday night, they'll have a cosplay thing in the bar.
Right.
So people go to all the panels and then basically go and have a few beers and dress up as Sonic the Hedgehog or something, you know, which seems like a much more sensible way of doing it to me, you know. Get a few beers down you first.
Yeah, we were sort of speculating on what Innsmouth cosplay would look like, really, wasn't it?
Weren't you looking at stick-on gills?
No, that was Lara. My wife did source some stick-on gills, but they were £16 each, so that's quite expensive for an Innsmouth look. There's probably a cheaper way to do it, but
yeah, makeup possibly. Kit. Yeah, it's got to be with stage makeup or something. You've got to be a way of doing gills. There has to be.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll dig out some of my old 1920s style dresses or something.
Nice.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm sort of toying with the idea of investing in tweed. I think because basically it's a running joke on this show.
I'm surprised you don't have any already, to be honest.
I did used to have a tweed suit, but unfortunately that was before I hit like mid-30s and my waist exploded. Hey. I can't fit into it anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm a bit like that with my frock coat.
Yeah, oh, it's just, I think that's the only thing that really upsets me. I can't fit into half my frilly shirts and things like that. I had a really good sort of Byronic outfit I used to ponce around London in, and I can't fit into it anymore. It's just like, damn it.
Well, you'll be visiting the Fat Face Innsmouth Spa then, I expect.
Yes, definitely. I'm not sure about their methods. Yeah, wonder if you get to write poetry while you're there.
Shog off poetry. So with the writing, I'm always interested in how people approach it. Do you have a method? Do you sit down a certain amount of time each day, or do you just sort of scribble notes on the fly? What's your process?
I do a little bit of both. There's definitely a certain amount of I've had an idea and I need to write it down right now that goes on. So yeah, there's a bit of that.
Usually at 5 a.m.
That has certainly happened. There are several notebooks with slightly like badly written out things, like at 5 a.m. where I've been leaning off the side of the bed going, I just need to write this. But when it actually comes to the writing itself, so when I sort of wrote my first book and then, well, both books during lockdown, I sort of set aside an hour a day where I'd finish work and I would do an hour's worth of writing. And sort of the way I made sure that was structured is I'm what they call a planner rather than a pantser. And I would always have the Fichtean curve of like storytelling, which is sort of the three-act structure where you're ramping up the tension until you hit crisis point, and then it sort of relaxes down into a nice hopeful ending. So I always try and use that sort of structure to sort of plan like the story beats throughout the whole of the book and things like that. And then when I sit down to write, it's not like I think I need to think then about like the next part of the story I'm going to write. I'm just like, right, I'm writing this chapter, which is this running up to this story beat today type thing. So it just helped me keep focused and keep the progress on really, which I think for me anyway, I mean, different things work for different people, but for me that made it easier to just keep going.
And then in terms of having a publisher, do you find that takes the pressure off a little bit in terms of copy proofing and marketing as well? Or do you still do a lot of marketing yourself?
You have to do a lot of marketing. I think that's the thing that they don't always tell you before you get into the world. Yep. It's like, you can never just do, oh yeah, I've written a book, isn't it great? the marketing is like a really big part of it, and I'd say it takes up quite a lot of time actually, to do it well. Time that I don't always have, I admit, but yeah, I've sort of tried to make the best of it. But having a publisher certainly helps, and I'm very grateful to Heather and Steve at Bridget's Gate for this, because they're very good. It's good to have a publisher to sort of have someone to do the edit and things like that, and then to sort of help you with like to find access to sort of interview opportunities and places to sort of promote the book and things like that. But also, crucially, cover design is a really big thing that you get with a publisher that you don't, if you did yourself, you'd have to sort of find an artist yourself and do all of that stuff. And I'm bad at art, so I definitely don't want to draw my own covers.
I got around that problem by marrying one, so there were other reasons.
I definitely would be remiss here if I don't plug the resident editor, which is my husband, who did edit both my books, which
Oh,
helped.
there you go. Well done, sir. Well done.
Yeah, it's, my partner's got a degree in English literature and things like that, so she's my proofreader. She's my beta reader, basically. Here, does this make sense? Just check this makes sense.
So always helpful.
That's one of the biggest things I find is, especially with like a novella or a novel, is keeping track of the plot. And when you know what's going to happen and why it happens. I had a story in recently, a submission, and it got to the end, and I thought, well, what's that all about? And it wasn't until the author explained it, I thought, oh, right. You don't want to make it too clear, but you've got to have some idea of what's going on, you know.
That's why I think beta readers are incredibly important. I mean, that's one thing. That's why I've always gone with publishers as opposed to doing it myself. But plus the fact I've been too lazy to format, because it's such a headache. But things like that. But yeah, it's the beta readers and finding ARC readers as well, because getting reviews are like gold dust, right? You know, but you know, so just to have somebody who spends the time doing that, because it's so time consuming, all these other bits and pieces of publishing that you don't think about. You know, it's like the amount of hours I waste mucking about creating promo graphics for things, and it's like, but that's a day gone now, not a day gone. I mean, a day gone. You know,
Ha.
Sorry, Innsmouth puns. Just
I
don't say it 3 times; you might appear.
That's what I've got the fishing spears for.
Nice.
Okay, so just to finish off, then, because I see the Innsmouth buses are pulling up shortly. Folklore. We mentioned folklore. We touched on it a couple of times, but is that something that interests you? And you have an interest in local folklore, because we're in the same area pretty much, right? I think we're in like Bedford. And what I found from, I'd go out and do little Innsmouth excursions here and there, and I discovered things I didn't even know. The Iron Age fort just down the road, and there's just so much history in what seems like a quote normal area. So is that something you draw on a lot as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, folklore is sort of a big inspiration for me, because I think it's sort of a really interesting way to look at sort of the different beliefs that people had over sort of different periods of time as well. And I quite like the sort of magical explanations for normal phenomena. And that's always quite sort of fascinating for me. And that's sort of one of the, I guess, things that I then sort of feed into some of my writing and that sort of thing. So, I mean, a good example of this, and then I'll come to my one of my favourite bits of local Bedfordshire folklore in a sec. But the book, my other book, Dissonance of Birdsong, is very much about sort of, it's got a cult element to it, which seems like it runs through the vein of a lot of things that I write. But it's based in Dark Ages Cornwall, and the idea behind it was sort of a very almost normal society, but all the sort of magic, if you like, at first for that society is a belief that they have this sacred bond with birds, and the sort of birds bring the mist from the sea into the settlement where they live to then help them breathe and breathe that mist back out into fire, which helps them survive the harsh winters and things like that.
Nice.
This is the kind of thing that I really like, is that sort of like everyday survival that people believed was made easier by kind of like that folkloric kind of nature magic and things like that.
Yeah.
So yes, like that's sort of one of my big loves, is folklore for that kind of reason of like survival, and survival being made easier by sort of the everyday magics and that kind of thing. And the promise, as promised, the favourite bit of Bedfordshire folklore is there's a little village where there's a tree on the border between two villages, basically. And the lore behind the tree is that it grew because they staked a highwayman through the heart with an elm tree, I think it was. And then the tree grew from the highwayman with the stake through his heart. So I love that, because that's literally all there is to the story. But it makes you wonder, did they believe he was a vampire? Like, what was going on there? And things like that. So that's pretty cool for me. Anyway. Yeah.
That's a new one. I mean, I'm going to be looking that one up.
It brought to mind Hope Hodgson there, the tree on the borderlands. You could it's right in itself, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Undead highwayman, you know, brilliant. Yeah,
I'd read that.
I would, yeah, absolutely.
I think when we were covering Man Size in Marble about the moving statues, and I mentioned then about there's a church, a village down near Houghton House. And in the church there were two effigies of a couple that were said to get up and move about, so it was almost the same kind of thing. And that village also has a ghostly knight, a phantom highwayman, a black shuck. Is this like a village of 30 houses? What's going on?
Yeah.
Well the church that actually inspired that is down near East Ham, the church has got these marble figures, and yes, they are supposed to come alive. And just down the road is Pluckley, which is, you know, the most haunted village in the UK.
We do seem to have our fair share of ghostly highwaymen around here.
Nice.
So, yeah.
I recently went to Bury St Edmunds to do a thing on M.R. James, and I went to where he grew up and things like that. And I was going round this place, and it's another place that has a claim on being one of the most haunted places in the country. And as I was going round, and I was reading through, because I bought this book about haunted Bury St Edmunds, and as I was going through, it was like, sightings of a big black dog. Well, I am in Suffolk, aren't I? So there's gotta be a shuck somewhere along the lines, aren't there?
Everywhere. There's actually a website that lists them all, and
is
there's
there?
You know.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to have a look at that. I bet that's brilliant.
Yeah.
But you could design a really good pub crawl. The Black Shuck pub crawl.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming in, Alex. A pleasure to see you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much.
Yeah, we look forward to Testament of the Stars coming out in August.
Thank you.
And people will be able to come along and buy it at the Innsmouth Literary Festival and meet you and all our other wonderful guests as well.
That they will.
Excellent.
Normally we say, because our guests have to stay over in Innsmouth, and normally we advise them to barricade the door and everything, but you're the first one that's come armed.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like we have to give you any advice at all.
Yeah. Try me, deep ones, because I'm coming for you. Like, I'm not barring the door. You should bar the door.
Nice. Yeah, I like it.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks both. Take care.
Thank you.
Our big thanks again to Alex for coming in. We're going to nip down to the new... They've got a new lounge. That's already open, I believe.
Indeed. The new lounge bar, yeah.
Let's go and visit the Marsh Lounge and see what delights await within.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, they've got a well-stocked bar, according to Zadok Allen. So if it's good enough for him, it's going to be good enough for us, I imagine.
All right, everyone seated? Everyone got a drink?
Nice.
Now, we brought you down here because, of course, it's we've not seen it for a while, and it was way too heavy, even for the stout Tin Mendes to carry upstairs. There it is, in the corner.
Yeah, here it is, bulbous as ever, Dagon's Sack.
Dagon's Sack.
Let me heft it onto the table. Here we go.
And let's have a delve. And we have a letter in from Tobias Nielsen from Copenhagen in Denmark. You might remember we mentioned Tobias an episode or two ago because he'd written a nice comment, sent a nice letter in to us. So, Tobias writes, "How do you do, fellow Earthlings? I'm a fairly long-time listener, first-time delver into Dagon's sack." The first time is always the worst. "And I find it relaxingly humid and of a pleasant temperature." Oh, that's good. That's good. "Anyway, I was pulled in by the Strange Shadows podcast, and being all caught up on that, I migrated to the Innsmouth Book Club podcast, which I'm happy to say I still have some episodes to go through. Episode 63, I can see you kindly mentioned me at the end. Bonus props for dropping the episode on my birthday. That's a fun coincidence." There's nothing coincidental about it, Tobias.
Stars are right.
Yeah. We're watching.
Yeah.
"Anyway, in one of the recent episodes, you had a listener writing in to ask why Earth was so important in the Cthulhu Mythos stories and why it's always the place as every cosmic horror shows up. You shared some interesting thoughts about how it could be a good bastion or central focus point, which I liked, but I just wanted to weigh in with my own thoughts on the matter, which I feel are in line with HPL's idea of our unimportance."
Yeah, he goes on to say that, "Who says that Earth is important? The only reason we see it as such is because of our point of view. We see a lot of transdimensional beings lurking around here, but who's to say that they're not doing that all over the place? We only know about the local crew, as it were, because this is the only planet we have our eyes on. Who knows who or what else resides elsewhere? And who's even to say that we've got the biggest and strongest monsters here? If you think about it, maybe Cthulhu and all the rest of them are mere interns or students." I like that. "And Earth is something of a school project for them. Our entire existence could be but a blink of their three-lobed burning eyes. And the only reason they take such an interest is that they need to give a good presentation and we're the experiment being presented. Anyway, if that doesn't make you feel small and insignificant, I don't know what will. So, with that in mind, I bid you adieu. All the best with the upcoming festival, and I'm looking forward to catching up on the podcast. Best regards, Tobias Nielsen." Awesome. Yeah.
Thanks for that, Tobias. Yeah. It's a very good question, and I feel it's something maybe we should do a special on at some point. This whole idea of the what is the mythos and how does it fit in with our reality and other realities, perhaps. Be an interesting panel show.
Yeah, I think another one, we could actually get a couple out of that question, because it's a very good point what he brings up about, you know, who's to say that things aren't going on everywhere else, because there is quite a rich, untapped seam of sort of sci-fi Lovecraftian fiction, if you will, that's set on other planets. I mean, you've got the Smith stuff, but there is quite a lot of stuff out there, usually involving things like Amigo and things like that. And if you think about it, really, the whole Aliens franchise is kind of like that.
It's one of the most Lovecraftian non-Lovecraft films, isn't it? Definitely. Yeah.
Absolutely. So it'd be quite interesting to think about. But yeah, I like the idea of Cthulhu and that lot, but being the spots of the mythos world, you know, they're the gophers. Got that backwater planet, get some specimens, drive them insane, and have the report on my desk by Monday.
The thing that interests me with that is if we head into our ancient aliens theory, and I'm fluffing up my hair as we speak. It's that idea of, no, we weren't created by God or a God or a creator. We were created by an alien race. And then the question is, who created the alien race? And you go on, it's almost like a sort of reverse fractal, isn't it? Where you keep zooming out and zooming out and zooming out.
So it's very similar to a lot of the stuff that Colin Wilson wrote, things like the mind parasites things like that, that sort of pseudo-scientific stuff. There was a book, I can never remember who it was by, but I've got a paperback of it in the loft back up of family home, and it was called Prehistoric Germ Warfare.
Wow.
And it was basically that we are the results of germ warfare in the prehistoric era, with an accident, you know.
That's a nice
but
one.
There was, yeah, but there was the whole thing, the elder things, wasn't there, that we're sort of a byproduct.
It ties in exactly with the Mountains of Madness and that whole. And it would have been interesting to speculate how Lovecraft would have developed that, because I feel that it was his particular thing. We've spoken before about the mixing of science and, well, superstition, for want of a better word, or myth and legend, perhaps would be a better way, in a way that I don't think anyone else quite captured. And most people tend to have run with the horror of seeing a Shoggoth or a Deep Under, a bit like the sort of monster approach, you know, which is fine. But I wonder how he would have run with that theory and it sort of developed that.
The more scientific end. Yeah. I mean, you've got people like David Hambling who go from a more scientific angle.
Well, he is a scientist, David, isn't he?
Exactly, Yeah.
Well placed.
And I'd say Ligotti's goes from a more philosophical perspective. So it's interesting.
So that was my first thought, was this idea of perhaps we were created or came from the old ones, but then who created them? And is there someone that Cthulhu looks up to and is afraid of and will send Cthulhu mad if they see them, you know?
Well, you've got the Azathoth, aren't you? Who's supposed to be the sort of the big cojone.
The centre of all things.
The centre of all things. But before that, there's the Nameless Mist, isn't there? Who I seem to remember we've talked about recently again.
That did come up. Was it the Frank Belknap Long?
The
Horror from the Hills we were talking about. Yes, and Ubo Sathla, of course, which is another...
Ubo Sathla, the Unbegotten Source, indeed. Which, again, sounds like a band, doesn't it? The Unbegotten Source. Good to see them headlining Whitby on Sunday night.
It seems like however far you go, at some point you're going to run into a nameless source, an unbegotten mist, a dweller at the centre of everything, you know.
Clark Ashton Smith's starter kit, dweller in the
it's very interesting speculation. I think we will do a special on this at some time. I mean, the other sort of thought that I came up with is maybe there's just not that many planets that have got intelligent life on, and I'm not sure I include Earth in that
in the loosest sense of the term.
So maybe we're one of the few planets that has a life form on it that is of interest, is not the word, or perhaps value in some way. You know, that idea of we're being farmed from outer space kind of thing.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. That's a great question. It's another one of them we could do, like you say, we could do an entire show on it.
So thanks for that, Tobias. That was an interesting question. And it looks like we might get a special episode out of that. And hope you enjoy the rest of the episode, and do let us know any other thoughts or questions that you have. And I believe we've had another comment as well, Ian.
Indeed, yeah. It was on the Frank Belknap Long Facebook page from JB Lee, and it's in relation to our last episode, which was about the Horror from the Hills. And he says that Little talks about fishes from outside, pretty much describing the Space Eaters, another of Long's creations. And between that and the Halpin Chalmers reference, I believe Long was building his own subset of Yog-Sothothery, not unlike DeBille's Melandoth cycle and Campbell's Brichester mythos. And he goes on to say, because we were talking about other appearances of Chalkner Faun and things like that, I couldn't believe I'd forgotten about this, because it was a great story by T.E.D. Klein, who's best known for The Ceremonies. T.D. Klein wrote a story called Black Man with a Horn.
Ah, yes.
In which, which is in the Tales of the Cthulhu Mythos, that famous anthology, in which Long is clearly the protagonist. And I've no doubt that the character of the title, which is called Sugaron, is not a Shoggoth, as some have said, but a corruption of the dread name Chorgner Faun. What other mythos creature would be both connected with Long and appear in silhouette to be a man with a horn to his lips, the trunk with the disc? That is a great, great observation. Thank you for that.
Yeah, that's a very good comment. Yeah, and yeah, I read Black Man with the Horn years ago. So wasn't that a short story that he later converted into a novel?
No, that was the events at Poroff Farm.
That was Poroff Farm.
That was the events at Poroff Farm that later became the ceremonies.
Right. I've got that the wrong way around. But actually, we should cover some T.E.D. Klein at some point.
That would be either that or Poroff Farm would be a good one to do. Ceremonies, I love it, but it's one of the longest books I think I've ever read. It's like, seriously, you could build igloos out of it. It's enormous.
And I think it does touch on this idea again that Lovecraft was so unprecious with his creation that all of these sort of, if we can call them offshoot authors or members of the Lovecraft circle, were able to adapt and still continue to adapt today this rather fluid mythos, which is what keeps it fresh and interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, without it, I wouldn't have a job, you know? but what wave are we part of? I mean, we're sort of the sort of sixth or seventh wave of Lovecraftian author or something.
It's gotta be, isn't it? Yeah. And it shows no signs of slowing down. As we were saying to Alex earlier, the huge proliferation of new sort of small presses and independent publishers.
Yeah.
All promoting weird fiction.
It's marvelous. Yeah, it's sort of, I hate to jinx it by saying it, but it does feel like we're in sort of like some kind of another golden age to a degree, because a lot of the stuff from the golden age is now back in the public spotlight, and along with a fresh crop of people who have basically taken that ball and run with it. So I think it's a great time to be doing it.
There we go. So, two very good letters there. Do keep them coming in. You can ask a specific question to Dagon at dagonsack@outlook.com. We did ask him to buy us his question, but he said, well, I'll paraphrase, he said, go away, I'm busy. So I thought, right, well, we don't want to push him, but hopefully we gave some sort of semi-coherent answer, and that is something we'll return to.
Yeah.
Of course, you can also send us questions or comments to InnsmouthBookClub@outlook.com, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page and on our Patreon page. And while you're on our Patreon page, please do take a look at our membership offers. We've got three tiers of membership. When you sign up, you get access to bonus content not only for the Innsmouth Book Club, but also for Strange Shadows, our Clark Ashton Smith podcast. You get a copy of Innsmouth News that goes out quarterly now. That's a newsletter filled with articles and various other items and bits and pieces. You're going to get a discount on our merch page, which is in the process of being set up now. And you also get free entry to wonderful events such as the Innsmouth Literary Festival. And I know two of our patrons, Mark and Gary, have already let us know they're coming along. So it'll be good to see those there. And as always, we'd like to thank our existing patrons. We really do appreciate your support. We'll be putting up another patron poll very soon to decide what the next story we're going to cover is. And actually, next time, we're doing a patron special, I believe.
Indeed, yeah. We're going to go back to Mr. Long. We're going to look at Frank Belknap Long's biography of Mr. Lovecraft, A Dreamer on the Night Side.
So big thanks again to Alexandra Beaumont for coming in. Thanks for joining us on today's excursion. We're all heading towards the big yellow bus now and hightailing it out of Innsmouth. With that, it's goodbye from me, Rob Poynton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.